A service call, he thought, leaping up automatically to get it. But it was not. A woman's voice said softly in his ear, "Jack?" "Yes," he said.
"This is Doreen. I just wondered if you were okay."
"I'm fine," he said, seating himself on the edge of the bed.
"Do you think you'd want to come over tonight, to my place?"
He hesitated.
He said. "We could play records and talk. Arnie lent me a lot of rare old stereophonic LP records from his collection. Some of them are awfully scratchy, but some are terrific. He's quite a collector, you know. He has the largest collection of Bach on Mars. And you saw his harpsichord."
So that's what that had been, there in Arnie's living room.
"Is it safe?" he asked.
"Yes. Don't worry about Arnie. He's not possessive, if you know what I mean." Jack said, "Okay, I'll be over." And then he realized that he couldn't because he had to be available for service calls, unless he could switch it through her phone.
"That's no problem," she said when he explained it to her. "I'll call Arnie and tell him."
Dumbfounded, he said, "But,
Jack, you're out of your mind if you think we can do it any other way. Arnie knows everything that goes on in the settlement. Leave it to me, dear. I'll call him right now. And you come right on over here. If any calls come through while you're on your way, I'll write them down, but I don't think there will be any. Arnie doesn't want you out fixing people's toasters. He wants you for his own jobs, for making that machine for talking to the Steiner boy."
"Okay," he said. "I'll be over. Goodbye." He hung up the phone. 10 minutes later, he was on his way, flying the bright and shiny E Company repair ship through the night sky of Mars, to Lewistown and Arnie Kott's mistress. Chapter 8 David Bolin knew that his grandfather Leo had a lot of money and didn't mind spending it. For instance, before they had even left the rocket terminal building, the old man in his stiff suit with his vest and gold cufflinks — it was the suit that the boy had watched to catch sight of along the ramp from where the passengers appeared — stopped at the flower counter and bought the boy's mother a bunch of large blue earth flowers. And he wanted to buy something for David, too, but they didn't have any toys, only candy, which Grandfather Leo bought, a 2-pound box. Under his arm, Grandfather Leo had a white carton tied with string. He hadn't let the rocket ship officials take it and put it with the luggage. When they had left the terminal building and were in his dad's copter, Grandfather Leo opened the package. It was full of Jewish bread and pickles and thin-sliced corned beef wrapped in protective plastic, 3 pounds of corned beef in all.
"My gosh!" Jack exclaimed in delight. "All the way from New York. You can't get that out here in the colonies, Dad."
"I know that, Jack," Grandfather Leo said. "A Jewish fella told me where to get it, and I liked it so much I knew you'd like it. You and I have the same tastes." He chuckled, pleased to see how happy he had made them. "I'm going to make you a sandwich when we get to the house. First thing we get there." The copter rose now above the rocket ship terminal and passed on over the dark desert. "How's the weather you've been having here?" Grandfather Leo asked.
"Lots of storms," Jack said. "Practically buried us a week or so ago. We had to rent power equipment to dig out."
"Bad," Grandfather Leo said. "You ought to get that cement wall up you were talking about in your letters."
"It costs a fortune to have construction work done out here," Sylvia said. "It's not like back on Earth."
"I know that," Grandfather Leo said. "But you got to protect your investment. That house is worth a lot. And the land? You have water nearby. Don't forget that."
"How could we forget that?" Sylvia said. "Good Lord, without the ditch, we'd die."
"That canal any wider this year?" Grandfather Leo asked.
"Just the same," Jack said.
David spoke up.
"They dredged it, Grandfather Leo. I watched them. The UN men, they used a big machine that sucked up the sand from the bottom, and the water's a lot cleaner. So my dad shut off the filter system, and now when the rider comes and opens the gate our way, we can pump it so fast that my dad let me put in a whole new vegetable garden I can water with overflow. And I have corn and squash and a couple of carrots, but something ate all the beets. We had corn last night from it. We put up a fence to keep those little animals from getting in. What are they called, Dad?"
"Sand rats, Leo," Jack said. "As soon as David's garden started to bear, the sand rats moved in. They're yay long." He held up his hands to show. "Harmless, except that they can eat their weight in 10 minutes. The older settlers warned us, but we had to try." "Good to grow your own produce," Grandfather Leo said. "Yeah, you wrote me about the garden, David. I'd like to see it tomorrow.
Tonight I'm tired. That's a long trip I took. Even with the new ships they got. What do they call it? Fast as light? But it really isn't. Still a lot of time taking off and landing and a lot of concussion. I had a woman next to me. She was terrified. Thought we'd burn up. It got so hot inside there, even with the air conditioning. I don't know why they let it get so hot. They certainly charge enough. But it's a big improvement over... Remember the ship you took when you emigrated years ago? 2 months. Jack said, Leo, you brought your oxygen mask, I hope. Ours is too old now. Unreliable. Sure, I got it in my brown suitcase. Don't worry about me. I can take this atmosphere. I got a different heart pill, really improved. Everything's improving back home. Of course, it's overcrowded, but more and more people going to be emigrating over here. Take my word for that. Smog's so bad back home, it nearly kills you. David spoke up. Grandfather Leo, the man next door, Mr. Steiner, he took his own life, and now his son Manfred is home from the camp for anomalous children, and my dad is building a mechanism so he can talk to us.
Well, Grandfather Leo said in a kindly way. He beamed at the boy. That's interesting, David. How old is this boy?
10, David said, but he can't talk at all to us yet. But my dad is going to fix that up with his mechanism, and you know who my dad is working for right now? Mr. Cott, who runs the Water Workers Union and their settlement. He's really a big, important man.
I believe I heard about him, Grandfather Leo said, with a wink at Jack, which the boy caught. Jack said to his father, Dad, are you still going ahead with this business of buying land in the FDR range?
Oh, certainly, Grandfather Leo said. You bet your life, Jack. Naturally, I came out on this trip sociably to see you all, but I couldn't have taken off so much time as this unless it was business, too.
I hoped you'd given that up, Jack said.
Now, Jack, Grandfather Leo said, don't you worry. You let me worry if I'm doing the right thing. I've been in land investment for many years now. Listen, you going to pilot me out there to that mountain range so I can take a first-hand look? I got a lot of maps. I want to see with my own eyes, though.
You're going to be disappointed when you see it, Sylvia said. It's so desolate there, no water, scarcely anything living.
Let's not worry about it right now, Grandfather Leo said with a smile at David. He nudged the boy in the ribs. Good to see a young man straight and healthy and out here away from the polluted air we have back home.
Well, Mars has its drawbacks, Sylvia said. Try living with bad water or no water at all for a while and you'll see.
I know, Grandfather Leo said soberly. You people sure have guts to live out here, but it's healthy, don't forget that.
Below them now, the lights of Bunchwood Park glittered. Jack turned the copter toward the north and their home. As he piloted the Yee Company copter, Jack Boland glanced at his father and marveled at how little he had aged, how vigorous and well-knit Leo looked, for a man in his late 70s, and still at his job, full-time, getting as much enjoyment out of speculating as ever. And yet, although it did not show, he was certain that the long trip from Earth had tired Leo out more than he admitted. In any case, they were almost at the house now. The gyro compass reading was 7.08054. They were only minutes away. When they had parked on the roof of the house and had gone downstairs, Leo at once fulfilled his promise. In the kitchen, he set to work, joyfully making each of them a kosher corned beef sandwich on Jewish bread. Soon they were all seated in the living room, eating. Everyone was peaceful and relaxed.
"You just don't know how we're starved for food of this sort," Sylvia said finally. "Even on the black market..."
She glanced at Jack.
"Sometimes you can pick up delicatessen foods on the black market," Jack said, "although lately it's gotten harder. We don't, personally. No moral reason, it's just too expensive."
They talked for a while, finding out about Leo's trip and about conditions back home. David was sent to bed at 10:30, and then at 11, Sylvia excused herself and went to bed too. Leo and Jack were left in the living room, still sitting, just the two of them. Leo said, "Can we step outside and take a glance at the boys' garden? You got a big flashlight?" Finding his trouble lantern, Jack led the way out of the house and into the cold night air. As they stood at the edge of the patch of corn, Leo said to him in a low voice, "How are you and Sylvia getting along these days?"
"Fine," Jack said, a little taken aback by the question. "Seems to me there's a coolness between the two of you," Leo said. "It sure would be terrible, Jack, if you grew apart. That's a fine woman you got there, one in a million." "I recognize that," Jack said uncomfortably.
"Back home," Leo said,
When you were a young fellow, you always played around a lot. But I know you're settled down now.
I am, Jack said, and I think you're imagining things.
You do seem withdrawn, Jack, his father said. I hope that old trouble of yours, you know what I mean, isn't bothering you. I'm talking about...
I know what you're talking about.
Relentlessly, Leo went on. When I was a boy, there was no mental illness like there is now. It's a sign of the times. Too many people, too much overcrowding. I remember when you first got sick, and a long time before that, say from when you were 17 on, you were cold toward other people, uninterested in them, moody, too. Seems to me you're like that now.
Jack glared at his father. This was the trouble with having one's folks visit. They could never resist the temptation to resume their old jobs as the all-wise, the all-knowing. To Leo, Jack was not a grown man with a wife and child. He was simply his son, Jack.
Look, Leo, Jack said. Out here there are very few people. This is a sparsely settled planet as yet. Naturally, people here are less gregarious. They have to be more inner-directed than back home, where it's, like you said, just a mob scene day after day.
Leo nodded.
But that should make you more glad to see fellow humans.
If you're referring to yourself, I'm very glad to see you.
Sure, Jack, Leo said. I know. Maybe I'm just tired. But you don't seem to say much. You're preoccupied.
My work, Jack said. This boy Manfred, this autistic child, I have that on my mind all the time.
But, as in the old days, his father could see through his pretexts effortlessly, with true parental instinct.
Come on, boy, Leo said. You got a lot on your mind, but I know how you work. Your job is with your hands, and I'm talking about your mind. It's your mind that's turned inward. Can you get that psychotherapy business here on Mars? Don't tell me no, because I know better.
I'm not going to tell you no, Jack said, but I will tell you that it's none of your goddamn business.
Beside him in the darkness, his father seemed to shrink, to settle.
Okay, boy, he murmured. Sorry I butted in.
They were both uncomfortably silent.
Hell, Jack said. Let's not quarrel, Dad. Let's go back inside and have a drink or something and then turn in. Sylvia fixed up a good soft bed for you in the other bedroom. I know you'll have a good rest.
Sylvia is very attentive to a person's needs, Leo said, with a faint note of accusation toward his son.
Then his voice softened as he said, Jack, I always worry about you. Maybe I'm old-fashioned and don't understand about this mental illness business. Everybody seems to have it nowadays. It's common, like flu and polio used to be, like when we were kids and almost everybody caught measles. Now you have this. One out of every three, I heard on TV one time. Schizo, whatever. I mean, Jack, with so much to live for, why would anyone turn his back on life like these schizo people do? It doesn't make sense. You got a whole planet to conquer here. Tomorrow, for instance, I'm going with you to the FDR Mountains, and you can show me around all over, and then I've got all the details on legal procedure here. I'm going to be buying. Listen, you buy in too, you hear me? I'll advance you the money.
He grinned hopefully at Jack, showing his stainless steel teeth.
It's not my cup of tea, Jack said, but thanks. I'll pick out the parcel for you, Leo offered.
No, I'm just not interested.
You enjoying your job now, Jack? Making this machine to talk to the little boy who can't speak? Sounds like a worthy occupation. I'm proud to hear about it. David is a swell kid, and boy, is he proud of his dad.
I know he is, Jack said.
David doesn't show any signs of that schizo thing, does he?
No, Jack said.
Leo said, I don't know where you got yours, certainly not from me. I love people.
I do too, Jack said.
He wondered how his father would act if he knew about Doreen. Probably Leo would be grief-stricken. He came from a straight-laced generation, born in 1924, a long, long time ago. It was a different world then. Amazing how his father had adapted to this world now. A miracle. Leo, born in the boom period following World War I, and now standing here on the edge of the Martian desert. But he still would not understand about Doreen, about how vital it was for him to maintain an intimate contact of this sort, at any cost. Or rather, almost any cost.
What's her name? Leo said.
What? Jack stammered.
I got a little of that telepathic sense, Leo said in a toneless voice.
don't I? After a pause, Jack said, evidently.
Does Sylvia know?
No.
I could tell because you didn't look me in the eye.
Balls, Jack said fiercely.
Is she married, too? She got kids, too, this other woman you're mixed up with?
Jack said in as level a voice as possible, why don't you use your telepathic sense and find out?
I just don't want to see Sylvia hurt, Leo said.
She won't be, Jack said.
Too bad, Leo said, to come all this way and find out something like this.
Well, he sighed.
I got my business anyhow. Tomorrow you and I'll get up good and early and get started.
Jack said, don't be too harsh a judge, Dad.
All right, Leo agreed. I know, it's modern times. You think by this playing around you keep yourself well, right?
Maybe so. Maybe it's a way to sanity. I don't mean you're not sane.
Just tainted, Jack said with violent bitterness.
Christ, your own father, he thought. What an ordeal. What a miserable tragedy.
I know you'll come out okay, Leo said. I can see now that you're struggling. It's not just playing around.
I can tell by your voice. You got troubles.
Same ones you always had, only as you get older, you wear out and it's harder, right?
Yeah, I see that.
This planet is lonely. It's a wonder all you emigrants didn't go crazy right off the bat. I can see why you would value love anywhere you can find it. What you need is something like what I've got, this land thing of mine. Maybe you can find it in building your machine for that poor mute kid. I'd like to see him.
You will, Jack said. Possibly tomorrow.
They stood for a moment longer, and then they walked back into the house.
Does Sylvia still take dope? Leo asked.
Dope? He laughed.
Phenobarbital, yes, she does.
Such a nice girl, Leo said. Too bad she's so tense and worries so much. And helping that unfortunate widow next door, like you were telling me.
In the living room, Leo seated himself in Jack's easy chair, crossed his legs and leaned back, sighing, making himself comfortable so that he could continue talking. He definitely had much more to say, on a variety of subjects, and he intended to say it. In bed, Sylvia lay almost lost in sleep, her faculties doused by the 100-milligram tablet of phenobarbital which she had taken, as usual, upon retiring. Vaguely, she heard the murmur of her husband's and her father-in-law's voices from the yard. Once, their tone became sharp, and she had sat up, alarmed.
"Are they going to bicker?" she asked herself.
"God, I hope not. I hope Leo Stay isn't going to disrupt things." However, their voices had sunk back down, and now she rested easily once more. "He certainly is a fine old man," she thought, much like Jack, only more set in his ways. Lately, since he had started working for Arnie Cott, her husband had changed. No doubt it was the eerie job which he had been given. The mute, autistic Steiner boy upset her, and she had been sorry from the first to see him appear. Life was complicated enough already. The boy flitted in and out of the house, always running on his toes, his eyes always darting as if he saw objects not present, heard sounds beyond the normal range. If only time could be turned back and Norbert Steiner could be somehow restored to life. If only... In her drugged mind, she saw in a flash that ineffectual little man setting out in the morning with his suitcases of wares, salesman off on his rounds, yogurt and blackstrap molasses. Is he still alive somewhere? Perhaps Manfred saw him, lost as the boy was, according to Jack, in disfigured time. What a surprise is in store for them when they make contact with the boy and find they have rekindled that sad little specter. But more likely their theory is right, and it is the next. He sees the next. They will have what they want. Why is it, Jack? What do you want it for, Jack? Affinity between you and that ill child, that it? Oh. Her thoughts gave way to darkness. And then what? Will you care about me again? No affinity between the sick and the sound. You are different. It weighs me down. Leo knows it. I know it. Do you care? She slept. High in the sky circled meat-eating birds. At the base of the windowed building lay their excrement. He picked up the wads until he held several. They twisted and swelled like dough, and he knew there were living creatures within. He carried them carefully into the empty corridor of the building.
One wad opened, parted with a split in its woven hair-like side. It became too large to hold, and he saw it now in the wall, a compartment where it lay on its side, the rent so wide that he perceived the creature within. Gubbish. A worm coiled up made of wet, bony white pleats, the inside gubbish worm from a person's body. If only the high-flying birds could find it and eat it down like that. He ran down the steps which gave beneath his feet, boards missing. He saw down through the sieve of wood to the soil beneath, the cavity, dark, cold, full of wood so rotten that it lay in damp powder, destroyed by gubbish rot. Arms lifted up, tossing him to the circling birds. He floated up, falling at the same time. They ate his head off. And then he stood on a bridge over the sea. Sharks showed in the water their sharp cutting fins. He caught one on his line, and it came sliding up from the water, mouth open, to swallow him. He stepped back, but the bridge caved in and sagged so that the water reached his middle. It rained gubbish now. All was gubbish, wherever he looked. A group of those who didn't like him appeared at the end of the bridge and held up a loop of shark teeth. He was emperor. They crowned him with the loop, and he tried to thank them. But they forced the loop down past his head to his neck, and they began to strangle him. They knotted the loop, and the shark teeth cut his head off. Once more he sat in the dark, damp basement with the powdery rot around him, listening to the tidal water lap-lapping everywhere. A world where gubbish ruled, and he had no voice. The shark had cut his voice out. "I am Manfred," he said.
"I tell you," Arnicott said to the girl beside him in the wide bed, "you're really going to be delighted when we make contact with him. I mean, we got an inside track there. We got the future, and where else do you think things happen except in the future?"
Stirring, Doreen Anderton murmured. "Don't go to sleep," Arnie said, leaning over to light another cigarette. "Listen, guess what? A big-time land speculator came over from Earth today, although really the speculator registered under an assumed name. We checked with the carrier, and he got right out of there, eluding our guy. I predicted they'd be showing up. Listen, when we hear from that Steiner kid, it'll blow the lid off this whole thing, right?" He shook the sleeping girl. "If you don't wake up," Arnie said, "I'm going to shove you right out of bed on your ass, and you can walk home to your apartment." Doreen groaned, turned over, sat up. In the dim light of Arnicott's master bedroom, she sat palely translucent, tucking her hair back from her eyes and yawning. One strap of her nightgown slipped down her arm, and Arnie saw with appreciation her high, hard left breast with its gem of a nipple set dead center. "Gosh, I really got a gal," Arnie said to himself. "She's really something. And she's done a terrific job in keeping that Bolan from shucking it all and wandering off the way those hebephrenic schizophrenics do. I mean, it's almost impossible to keep them at the grindstone. They're so moody and irresponsible. That guy Bolan, he's an idiot savant, an idiot who can fix things, and we have to cater to his idiocy. We have to yield. You can't force a guy like that. He don't force." Arnie took hold of the covers and tossed them aside off Doreen. He smiled at her bare legs, smiled to see her draw her nightgown down to her knees. "How can you be tired?" he asked her. "You ain't done nothing but lie. Isn't that so? Is lying there so hard?" She eyed him narrowly. "No more," she said. "What?" he said. "You kidding? We just begun. Take off that nightgown." Catching it by the hem, he whisked it back up once more. He put his arm beneath her, lifted her up, and in an instant had it off over her head. He deposited it on the chair by the bed. "I'm going to sleep," Doreen said, closing her eyes, "if you don't mind." "Why should I mind?" Arnie said. "You're still there, aren't you? Awake or asleep? You're plenty there in the flesh, and how?" "Ouch," she protested. "Sorry." He kissed her on the mouth. "Didn't mean to hurt you." Her head lolled. She actually was going to sleep. Arnie felt offended. But what the hell, she never did much anyhow. "Put my nightgown back on me," Doreen murmured, "when you're through." "Yeah, well, I'm not through." "I'm good for an hour more," Arnie said to himself, "maybe even two. I sort of like it this way, too. A woman asleep don't talk. That's what spoils it when they start to talk, or make those moans. He could never stand the moans." He thought, "I'm dying to get results on that project of Bolan's. I can't wait. I know we're going to hear something really downright wonderful when we do start hearing. The closed-up mind of that kid, think of all the treasures it contains. Must be like fairyland in there, all beautiful and pure and real innocent." In her half-sleep, Doreen moaned. Chapter 9.
Into Leo Boland's hand, his son Jack put a large green seed. Leo examined it, handed it back.
"What did you see?" Jack asked.
"I saw it, the seed."
"Did anything happen?"
Leo pondered, but he could not think of anything he had seen happen, so at last he said, "No." Seated at the movie projector, Jack said, "Now watch." He snapped off the lights in the room, and then, on the screen, an image appeared as the projector whirred. It was a seed embedded in soil. As Leo watched, the seed split open. Two probing feelers appeared. One started upward, the other divided into fine hairs and groped downward. Meanwhile, the seed revolved in the soil. Enormous projections unfolded from the upward-moving feeler, and Leo gasped.
"Say, Jack," he said, "some seeds you got here on Mars. Look at it go. My gosh, it's working away like mad."
Jack said, "That's a plain, ordinary lima bean, the same as I gave you just now. This film is speeded up, 5 days compressed into seconds. We can now see the motion that goes on in a germinating seed. Normally, the process takes place too slowly for us to see any motion at all."
"Say, Jack," Leo said, "that's really something.
So this kid's time rate is like this seed."
"I understand. Things that we can see move would whiz around him so darn fast they'd be practically invisible. And I bet he sees slow processes like this seed here. I bet he can go out in the yard and sit down and watch the plants growing, and 5 days for him is like, say, 10 minutes for us."
Jack said, "That's the theory, anyhow." He went on then to explain to Leo how the chamber worked. The explanation was filled with technical terms, however, which Leo did not understand, and he felt a little irritable as Jack droned on. The time was 11 a.m., and still Jack showed no sign of taking him on his trip over the FTR Mountains. He seemed completely immersed in this.
"Very interesting," Leo murmured at one point.
"We take a tape recording done at 15 inches per second and run it off from Manfred at 3 3/4 inches per second. A single word, such as tree. And at the same time, we flash up a picture of a tree and the word beneath it, a still, which we keep in sight for 15 or 20 minutes. Then what Manfred says is recorded at 3 3/4 inches per second, and for our own listening, we speed it up and replay at 15.
Leo said, "Listen, Jack, we just got to get going on that trip."
"Christ," Jack said, "this is my job." He gestured angrily. "I thought you wanted to meet him. He'll be over here any time now. She sends him over." Breaking in, Leo said, "Look, son, I came millions of miles to have a look at that land. Now, are we going to fly there or not?"
Jack said, "We'll wait until the boy comes, and we'll take him with us."
"Okay," Leo said. He wanted to avoid friction. He was willing to compromise, at least as much as was humanly possible.
"My God, here you are for the first time in your life on the surface of another planet. I should think you'd want to walk around, take a look at the canal, the ditch."
Jack gestured over toward the right. "You haven't even glanced at it, and people have been wanting to see the canals. They've argued about their existence for centuries." Feeling chagrined, Leo nodded dutifully.
"Well, show me, then."
He followed Jack from the workshop, outdoors, into the dull, ruddy sunlight.
"Cold," Leo observed, sniffing the air.
"Say, it's sure easy to walk around. I noticed that last night I felt like I weighed only 50 or 60 pounds. Must be because Mars is so small, right? Must be good for people with cardiac conditions, except the air is so thin. I thought last night it was the corned beef that made me..."
"Leo," his son said, "be quiet and look around, will you?"
Leo looked around. He saw a flat desert with meager mountains in the far distance. He saw a deep ditch of sluggish brown water, and beside the ditch a moss-like vegetation, green. That was all, except for Jack's house and the Steiner house a little farther on. He saw the garden, but he had seen that last night.
"Well," Jack said.
Being obliging, Leo said,
"Very impressive, Jack. You've got a nice place here. A nice little modern place. A little more planting, landscaping, and I'd say it was perfect."
Grinning at him crookedly, Jack said, "This is the dream of a million years, to stand here and see this."
"I know that, son, and I'm exceptionally proud of what you've accomplished, you and that fine woman."
Leo nodded solemnly.
"Now, can we get started? Maybe you could go over to that other house where that boy is and get him. Or did David go over? Maybe David's getting him. I don't see him around."
"David's at school. He was picked up while you were sleeping."
Leo said, I don't mind going over and getting that boy, Manfred, or whatever his name is, if it's okay with you.
Go ahead, Jack said. I'll come along. They walked past a small ditch of water, crossed an open field of sand and sparse fern-like plants, and arrived at the other house. Leo heard from within the sound of small girls' voices. Without hesitation, he ascended the steps to the porch and rang the bell. The door opened, and there stood a big blonde-haired woman with tired, pain-filled eyes.
"Good morning," Leo said. "I'm Jack Boland's dad. I guess you're the lady of the house. Say, we'll take your boy with us on a trip and bring him back safe and sound."
The big blonde woman looked past him to Jack, who had come up on the porch. She said nothing but turned and went off back into the interior of her house. When she returned, she had a small boy with her.
"So this is the schizo little fellow," Leo thought. "Nice looking, you'd never know in a million years."
"We're going on a ride, young man," Leo said to him. "How does that sound?"
Then, remembering what Jack had said about the boy's time sense, he repeated what he had said very slowly, dragging each word out. The boy darted past him and shot down the steps and off toward the canal. He moved in a blur of speed and disappeared from sight behind the Boland house.
"Mrs. Steiner," Jack said, "I want you to meet my father."
The big blonde woman put out her hand vaguely. She did not seem to be all there herself, Leo observed. However, he shook hands with her.
"Glad to meet you," he said politely. "Sorry to hear about the loss of your husband. It's a terrible thing, something striking like that, without any warning. I know a fellow back in Detroit, good friend of mine, did the same thing one weekend. Went out of the shop and said goodbye, and that was the last anybody saw of him."
Mrs. Steiner said, "How do you do, Mr. Boland?" "We'll go round up Manfred," Jack said to her. "We should be home late this afternoon." As Leo and his son walked back, the woman remained where she was on the porch, looking after them.
"Pretty odd herself," Leo murmured. Jack said nothing.
They located the boy, standing off by himself in David's overflow garden, and presently the three of them were in the Yi Company copter, flying above the desert in the direction of the line of mountains to the north. Leo unfolded a great map, which he had brought with him, and began to make marks on it.
"I guess we can talk freely," he said to Jack, nodding his head toward the boy. "He won't—"
He hesitated.
"You know."
"If he understands us," Jack said dryly, "it'll be—"
"Okay, okay," Leo said. "I just wanted to be sure."
He carefully refrained from marking the place on the map that he had heard would be the UN site. But he did mark their route, using the gyro compass reading visible on the dashboard of the copter.
"What rumors have you heard, son?" he asked. "About UN interest in the FDR range."
Jack said, "Something about a park or a power station."
"Want to know exactly what it is?"
"Sure." Leo reached into his inside coat pocket and brought out an envelope. From it he took a photograph, which he handed to Jack.
"Does this remind you of anything?"
Glancing at it, Jack saw that it was a picture of a long, thin building. He stared at it a long time.
"The UN," Leo said, "is going to build these. Multiple unit dwellings, whole tracts of them, mile after mile, with shopping centers, complete, supermarkets, hardware stores, drug stores, laundries, ice cream parlors. All built by slave equipment, those construction automatons that feed themselves their own instructions."
Presently, Jack said, "It looks like the co-op apartment house I lived in years ago when I had my breakdown."
"Exactly. The co-op movement will be in with the UN on this. These FDR mountains were once fertile, as everybody knows. There was plenty of water here. The UN hydraulic engineers believe they can bring enormous quantities of water up to the surface from the table below. The water table is closer to the surface in these mountains than anywhere else on Mars. This is the original water source for the canal network, the UN engineers believe."
"The co-op," Jack said in a strange voice. "Here on Mars."
"There'll be fine modern structures," Leo said. "It's quite an ambitious project. The UN will be transporting people here free, providing their passage right to their new homes, and the cost of buying each unit will be small. It will take quite a big slice of these mountains, as you might guess, and as I heard it, they expect it to be 10 to 15 years before the project is completed."
Jack said nothing.
"Mass emigration," Leo said. "This will ensure it."
"I guess so," Jack said.
The appropriations for this are fantastic, Leo said. The co-op alone is putting up almost $1 trillion. It has huge reserves of cash, you know. It's one of the richest groups on Earth. It has greater assets than the insurance group or any of the big banking systems. There's not a chance in the world that, with them in on it, the thing could fail. He added, the UN has been negotiating with them for 6 years on this matter.
Finally, Jack said, what a change it will mean for Mars, just to have the FDR range fertile, that alone.
And densely populated, Leo reminded him.
It's hard to believe, Jack said.
Yeah, I know, boy, but there's no doubt of it. Within another few weeks, it'll be generally known. I knew it a month ago. I've been getting investors I know to put up risk capital. I represent them, Jack. Alone, I just don't have the money.
Jack said, you mean your whole idea is to get here before the UN actually takes the land? You're going to buy it for very little, and then resell it to the UN for much more.
We're going to buy it in great pieces, Leo said, and then at once subdivide, cut it up into lots, say, 100 feet by 80. Title will be in the hands of a fairly large number of individuals, wives, cousins, employees, friends of the members of my group.
Of your syndicate, Jack said.
Yes, that's what it is, Leo said, pleased. A syndicate.
After a time, Jack said in a hoarse voice,
and you don't feel there's anything wrong with doing this?
Wrong in what sense? I don't get you, son.
Christ, Jack said, it's obvious.
Not to me. Explain.
You're gypping the entire population of Earth. They're the ones who will have to put up all the money. You're increasing the costs of this project in order to make a killing.
But, Jack, that's what's meant by land speculation.
Leo was puzzled.
What did you think land speculation was? It's been going on for centuries. You buy land cheap when nobody wants it because you believe for one reason or another that one day it will be worth a lot more. And it's inside tips that you go on. That's about all there is to go on when you get down to it. Every land speculator in the world will be trying to buy in when they get the word. In fact, they're doing that right now. I beat them here by a matter of days. It's this regulation that you have to actually be on Mars that gets them. They're not prepared at the drop of a hat to come here, so they've missed out. Because by nightfall, I expect to have put our deposit down on the land we want.
He pointed ahead of them. It's in there. I've got all sorts of maps. I won't have any trouble locating it. The location of the piece is in a vast canyon area called the Henry Wallace. To comply with the law, I have to actually set foot on the piece I intend to buy and place some permanent marker, fully identifiable, in an exposed spot. I have such a marker with me, a regulation steel stake, which bears my name. We'll land in the Henry Wallace, and you can help me drive the stake in. It's just a formality. It won't take more than a few minutes.
He smiled at his son. Looking at his father, Jack thought, he's insane. But Leo smiled calmly at him, and Jack knew that his father was not insane, that it was exactly as he said. Land speculators did this. It was their way of going about their business, and there really was such a mammoth UN co-op project about to start. As shrewd and experienced a businessman as his father could not be wrong. Leo Bolin and the men with him did not act on the basis of a rumor. They had top connections. There had been a leak, either at the co-op or the UN or both, and Leo was putting all his resources to work to take advantage of it.
It's the biggest news so far, Jack said, regarding the development of Mars.
He could still hardly believe it.
Long overdue, Leo said. Should have taken place right from the start. But they expected private capital to be put up. They waited for the other fella to do it.
This will change the lives of everybody who lives on Mars, Jack said.
It would alter the balance of power, create a totally new ruling class. Arnicott, Bosley Tuvim, the Union settlements and the national settlements would be small fry, once the co-op in conjunction with the UN had moved in. Poor Arnie, he thought. He won't survive this. Time, progress, and civilization, all will have passed him by. Arnie and his steam baths that waste water, his tiny symbol of pomp.
Now listen, Jack, his father said. Don't spread this information around because it's confidential. What we want to watch is crooked business at the abstract company. That's the outfit that records your title.
I mean, we put up our deposit, and then other speculators, especially local ones here, get tipped off and then have pull at the abstract company, so it turns out...
I see, Jack said.
The abstract company would predate the deposit of a local speculator, giving him seeming priority over Leo.
There must be many tricks that can be played in a game like this, Jack said to himself. No wonder Leo works carefully.
We've investigated the abstract company here, and it appears to be honest, but you never know when there's so much involved.
Suddenly, Manfred Steiner gave a hoarse grunt. Both Jack and Leo glanced up, startled. They had both forgotten about him. He was at the rear of the cab of the copter, his face pressed to the glass, staring down. He pointed excitedly. Far below, Jack saw a party of bleakmen threading its way along a mountain trail.
That's right, Jack said to the boy. People down there, probably hunting.
It occurred to him that very possibly Manfred had never seen a bleakman. I wonder what his reaction would be, Jack mused, if he found himself facing them all at once. How easy it would be to arrange it. All he had to do, really, was land the copter ahead of this particular party.
What are those? Leo asked, looking down. Martians?
That's what they are, Jack said.
I'll be darned.
Leo laughed.
So those are Martians. Well, they look more like aboriginal Negroes, like the African Bushmen.
They're closely related to them, Jack said.
Manfred had become quite excited. His eyes shone, and he ran back and forth from window to window, peering down and muttering.
What would happen if Manfred lived with a family of bleakmen for a time, Jack wondered. They moved slower than we do. Their lives are less complex and hectic. Possibly their sense of time is close to his. To the bleakmen, we Earthmen may very well be hypomanic types, whizzing about at enormous velocity, expending huge amounts of energy over nothing at all. But it would not bring Manfred into his own society, to put him with the bleakmen. In fact, he realized it might draw him so far away from us that there would be no chance of our ever communicating with him. Thinking that, he decided not to land the copter.
"Do those fellows do any work?" Leo asked. "Those Martians?"
"A few have been tamed," Jack said, as the phrase goes, "but most of them continue to exist as they always have, as hunters and fruit-gatherers. They haven't reached the farming stage yet."
When they reached the Henry Wallace, Jack set the copter down, and he and his father and Manfred stepped out onto the parched rocky soil.